Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. I am your host, James Jones, and it is February 2nd, 2017, the first episode of February, not the first day of February, because as I noted, it's the second. I am joined today by Mr. Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
I know numbers, Greg.
Yes.
I almost said it was the first day of February and then said, wait, no, I already said it wasn't. So.
And then you just undid all that good work with that explanation, bravo.
But you can't prove that I don't know numbers. You have to take my word for it for the time being. The smug disapproval you hear is Guillaume Veillette.
I can edit to make you say anything.
It's going to sound like...
I don't have to prove February that you 1st. Don't know numbers. I can just fake it.
But see, then you're going to have to make it sound like I'm like the recorded answering service on a telephone line. So
I think you'll find that people are more willing to accept fake news than you imagine.
The fact that stupid shit happens on this show is not news, Guillaume, nor is it fake. I'm also joined today because John is out and because he has some very exciting topics to talk about. Former host of Radio Free Nintendo, Dr. Jonathan Metz.
Yeah, to tell you the truth, guys, I'm feeling pretty tired tonight. I'm going to try to power through, but it feels a little bit like I've just been living today over and over again. I've been so busy. So busy. There's a lot going on. But yeah, I did get to try some things.
Did you run into Ned Ryerson or whatever?
This would be episode 508, probably.
Ish.
And somewhere in there. And it's time for new business. And as the guest and also as the person with the most interesting stuff to talk about, Johnny, why don't you kick us off?
Well, I'd be glad to. Thank you for having me. I come bearing a special report from the Penny Arcade Exposition South 2017. I got to attend PAX South last weekend with my friends from the Austin Mates podcast, which I've mentioned before. And we talked about it more in depth on that show on an episode that will come out at sometime soon, I think. About the kind of full experience. And I will say it was very similar to when we used to get to do PAX East with the RFN and Nintendo World Report crew. It was really fun, and we had a good time. I might say that I prefer PAX East a little bit just in terms of the layout, you know, of the event and some of the variety of activities there. But we still had a blast at PAX South, and it had a lot of the fun things that I appreciate the most about PAX, which is, you know, exciting exhibits, a lot of indie games, really fun attitude of the whole crowd, and some really cool installations like the Steel Battalion multiplayer room,
yeah.
Or the, you know, check out any retro game you can think of. I played Iggy's Wrecking Balls, and I also played...
Yeah.
Also played during a chiptune and nerdcore rap concert, I sat in a chair and played Dragon View on the Super Nintendo through a giant ROM cartridge that somebody had set up in there that had pretty much every Super Nintendo game. So nice. PAX is full of these wonderful, weird experiences. We also did some Johann Sebastian jousting, of course. But the main thing that I was excited to go do, and the reason I'm here to talk to you guys tonight, is that I got to play the Switch, because this was the first public appearance of the Nintendo Switch. We knew that it would be because of the timing, you know. It was only a couple weeks after the big unveiling. I could probably skip a lot of the details of what was there, what was not there, what I know and what I don't know. If I tell you that they were pretty much all the same demos that were at the New York event that Justin and Neil, or actually Neil wasn't there, but it was Justin and
Jared.
Jared, yes, who got to play it, take all those videos. It was a lot of the same stuff, so I don't have any major revelations for you. In fact, there were a couple things like the Fast demo wasn't available for us. We didn't get to do Skylanders and that kind of stuff. But I did get to play Snipper Clips and Mario Kart and Zelda and Splatoon 2 and ARMS, so, and 1-2 Switch even. So I felt like I got a really good sampling of some of this really early launch window type software. And I got to play with the hardware, which I was really excited about. So I guess I can take some questions from you guys, just if there's anything really specific that you're wondering, or if you just wondered what I thought of something about it. But my initial impression, and I guess just how I kind of feel about it walking away from that event and now having to wait a few more weeks before I have my own Switch, is that the graphics are really nice. The controls were complicated. There's a lot of choices and options that you have in most of these games. I learned that even something like ARMS can be played with a pro controller.
Yep.
And the more I think about it, the more I think, well, you know, because when you're doing motion controls, you have to use both of the Joy-Cons. That means that a pro controller kind of unlocks local two-player mode in that game, which they were showing. Otherwise, you're going to have to buy an expensive set of additional controllers. And I don't think a lot of people are going to do that, at least not at first. So, you know, I think definitely owning a pro controller is a kind of a must-have item for the Switch, just because I think for some games it'll be the best way to control them, and for others it'll be the best way to get to share the console with another person.
I don't know. I thought that buying another set of Joy-Cons would be the best thing, because then, like, you can do motion-controlled two-player games, and you can, you know, do four-player Bomberman, and it just costs you, like, quote-unquote, one extra controller.
Yeah, you might be right. I mean, it depends on whether you want to add in a charging grip and stuff like that. And it just gets back to complicated.
The Pro Controller's kind of got its own utility with it having, right, you know, that nice D-pad on there relative to, you know, what you don't have with Joy. So that's the kind of thing you might get anyway. Whereas, you know, so it's nice the fact that with something like ARMS, you can use that to at least approximate something that the Joy-Con control scheme does, because you, at least you don't feel like you absolutely have to buy another set, which, you know, I mean, the Pro Controller's expensive enough. And then another pair of Joy-Con is even more expensive than that.
So let me ask you this, Johnny. Did you try the Joy-Cons plus grip combo?
Yes, briefly, while playing Zelda.
How does that feel?
That's the way they had it set up for us just when we first walked up to the demo station. We were playing it on TV with the grip, and that was the only demo that had the grip controller. So it's the only time I got to try it. And I thought that it felt a little better than holding the system in handheld mode, where the Joy-Cons are attached to the screen and you're just holding it like a 3DS or a Vita. I think in that mode, the controls really feel like handheld controls. Like the size of the joysticks and the buttons and the shoulder buttons, it all feels like something you'd find on a 3DS. So it's all kind of miniaturized. It's a little cramped for my hands. It's maybe better suited for kids' hands, I think, or just smaller people. And so I felt playing with the Joy-Cons, especially as attached, is kind of like a last resort for me. It's like, I'll do that, and I think they're okay for a while, but I wouldn't want to play for a long duration that way. So the grip is more comfortable than that. I'd say it's, you know, it's an improvement. For me, even better was, and I asked the guy at the demo station, I was kind of surprised he said he let me do this, but I said, hey, can I just slip these off and just kind of hold them freestyle, kind of like a Wii Remote and Nunchuck combo from back when I played Twilight Princess? And he's like, yeah, go ahead, you know? And this was the crazy feeling. These things were, like, not attached or anything, didn't even have the wrist straps on them. So I'm just holding these tiny, expensive, like, prototype controllers in my hands. And, you know, I've got this burly Nintendo contractor, like, staring at me the whole time. But I just thought, this is cool. Like, it's was really the only chance I had in the whole event to really just kind of hold that controller in a more natural way like I would at home. And they felt pretty good. I think they're still small, so, like, you know, I wouldn't want to use it for hours and hours, which gives me pause with a game like Zelda. But just being able to, like, relax my shoulders, you know, kind of put my hands in my lap or to the side or stand up or walk around and not have to be attached to anything, it felt good. And those little controllers, I think, feel better when you can kind of palm them, you know, when you can kind of really fit them in your hand however you feel, however gives you the best access to the buttons you want. I think that's better, whereas when it's attached to the system, you also have to juggle balancing the weight of the whole system, you know? So
it's kind of like the Wii U problem, and the Wii U handled it with that weird ridge on the back that if you used your fingers, actually, it gave you a nice, like, pivot point. But there isn't something equivalent to that on the Switch.
Yeah, you know, that ridge was, I want to say there was a smaller version of it that was included in the very original gamepad prototype that we played back at E3 2010?
There was. With the,
no,
with
20,
the, with this,
2011.
2011 with the circle pads as opposed to regular sticks.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Which it's kind of surprised they didn't go that way with this system, to be honest, because, you know, given you're more likely to actually throw this in a bag than you ever were with the gamepad.
Yeah, but there's just no... I mean, if this is going to be Nintendo's primary system that they develop all their biggest games for, the Zeldas and the Marios, it's the circle pads to me are not sufficient for those kinds of games. And the joysticks on here, although I don't love them from at first use, they feel a little strange, partly because and I'm talking about the Joy-Con joysticks, that's hard to say. They're a little clicky near the dead zone. So like if you're moving the stick just a short throw and then you slide it around and kind of rotate it around, like if you think about like Mario 64 or Galaxy or whatever, if you're just trying to make Mario walk or crouch and sneak up on something, you can kind of feel these clicks in the joystick that almost kind of guide you to like, okay, this is how you, it's like a little bit of feedback to know that you've pushed it far enough to register. But then if you throw the joystick out towards the edge, like if you're running in a Mario game, you know, full blast, you put it out towards the edge and rotate it around, you don't feel that anymore. So like it's easier to spin it around the edge. It doesn't have like an octagon type cutout thing. It's more circular around the edge, but in the middle it feels a little more digital, like you can kind of set an angle more precisely. It's an interesting feeling, and all of this is wrapped into what's really a pretty small joystick. It's like...
It does seem quite small.
I would say smaller than the N64 joystick.
Ooh.
It's got a better texture on the pad.
Oh, what doesn't?
Yeah.
And it's not going to shred your palm.
Right. But yeah, it's tiny, you know, and it's a little weird playing a game that like Zelda that does feel grandiose and like, you know, feels like a console-ass console game. It's weird to be watching that on the TV and controlling it with the tiniest of joysticks and the daintiest of buttons that are on the Joy-Con. I'm curious to find how much in my own habits I end up playing the Switch that way, because I find it very intriguing, and I think it'll be great for tabletop mode when you're on the go. But just playing freestyle Joy-Cons while docked to the TV is an interesting prospect for me, and maybe it'll be good enough, but I still think I'll play most of Zelda on the Pro Controller. It's just bigger. It just fits my hands better, period. The buttons are almost twice as big. Everything about it is just, it's a lot easier to hit the button that you want to hit.
Yeah, and that's the thing, because if the Joy-Con plus grip was, say, 80% the experience of the Pro Controller, I would just spit out the extra money and just, okay, now I've got everything I need for pretty much any permutation of switchery. But it's sounding like, well, you probably should have a Pro Controller.
I've felt that way from the beginning, but that's not to say that I don't like the Joy-Cons. I think they're really neat. The more I think about them and I think maybe it didn't register with me at that Japan event where Koizumi introduced us to all the technology in the Joy-Con. It wasn't immediately apparent to me that they were going after making a modern Wii remote.
Dongle, like no nunchuck tied to it.
Because it was nice. I like that. But you're playing with the two hands kind of more free, but they weren't entirely free because of the cable.
Yeah. But now, I think in a very Nintendo way, they've realized, hey, not only is removing that that cable better for the user experience, and we can do that with our better technology, better batteries, etc. But also, you can now each use one of those controllers and play games with each other.
Right.
It's very clever. And by the way, I did get to do some of the snapping of, you know, putting the Joy-Cons on, and it feels good. I mean, it, you know, they're not overselling that, I think. So the gadgetry of the system is more appealing in person to me than it was when they first showed it. And so I am kind of excited just to have this stuff around, just to kind of play with it and get a feel for it. But every aspect of the Switch that I saw and got to touch, I would say, felt like it was well made. The Pro Controller is maybe a little bit cheap feeling, which is a little bit of a concern for me, just especially because of how expensive it is. It doesn't quite feel as meaty and high quality as I would like from a controller that costs that much. But I still think it's the best design of the controllers that are available right now. And, you know, they still haven't said anything about Wii Remote compatibility, for instance, or even GamePad compatibility. It seems not completely out of the question. GamePad probably less likely because of the way that it does wireless. But
yeah. Right.
Even 3DS compatibility.
One thing I was wondering about the Joy-Con in person, when you're using it separately in the kind of NES type of mode, did you get to do that at all?
That was the first time I played Switch. I was on Snipper Clips.
Yeah,
and I had the right hand Joy-Con with the joystick right in the middle of the controller.
Right. So the key thing I'm wondering about this is because they're keen to kind of show off with the wrist strap, which then kind of bulks it up a little bit and makes it more comfy. But of course, you know, if the whole selling point is, oh, you could just break it off, and it's not as convenient if it's like, oh, you could just break it off and then attach the wrist strap and all that. So for me, I think it has to be able to function pretty well just in its broken off state without the extra sort of padding of that wrist strap. So I was wondering if you got any kind of impressions of that.
I think you're going to want to keep those wrist straps around the TV wherever you keep the Switch most of the time. I don't necessarily think you're going to carry those wrist straps with you when you throw the Switch in a bag and go hop on a plane or a train somewhere. So I agree with you that they should work fine without those things. But to be honest, there's a reason that those wrist straps come with the extra piece of plastic. The Joy-Cons themselves, when you hold it sideways for like a split co-op game or something like that, or just a two-player split game, the Joy-Cons are really, really small. And I thought they worked well for 1-2 Switch and for ARMS, where, well, I guess in ARMS, you have to use both of them.
Yeah, and it's like the kind of vertical orientation.
Yeah,
orientation.
That feels pretty good, I'll say. And then for 1-2 Switch, I got to hold it in a few different ways, and some of them were kind of more like the types of things you would expect to do with a Wii Remote. Like I'm laying it in my hand and trying to balance it, or I'm, you know, holding it vertically and like shaking it up and down. It was very much like a WarioWare smooth moves kind of experience.
Yeah, did they have 8 different styles, like umbrella style? And
oh, I wish. Elephant. Yeah, I wish. No, but that stuff is fun. It definitely reminded me of the old days of playing Wii. And it is gimmicky, and it is something that I think I would only ever do in like very specific social settings. But it was a good time. And oh, by the way, I have to give a shout out to couple people who saw me at the event, and they were RFN listeners, and just were really
Did
nice.
Did you apologize?
No, they were they were really nice and really friendly. So shout outs to Johnson, who was actually my demo rep at 1-2 Switch, and Patrick. Patrick saw me, recognized my RFN t-shirt on the expo hall, and was just like, "Hey, dude, that was awesome." But yeah, you know, I would say the demo that really caught my attention the most, of course, was Zelda. And my biggest problem there was just I didn't get to play enough of it. It was a really long line to get in to play it at all. We waited about 2.5 hours to get in for a 20-minute gameplay session. And because it's the very, very, I think that's actually shorter than the E3 demo from last year. Maybe they just changed the timer on it. But because it's literally the beginning of the game, there's some cutscene stuff in the beginning that, and like, I don't really want to say tutorial, because that seems like probably more than it really is. But there are a couple places where you have to pick up the Sheikah Slate, and it tells you, hey, this has your map on it. You can use it to unlock doors and stuff. You know, there's a couple of very quick concept intros like that, and it just ate up a lot of our time. You know, it was such a limited time demo. I wanted to get through all that stuff as fast as possible and go out and run around. And I didn't get to do as much as I wanted to, but it definitely left me wanting more. You know, it's cool. That was my first time playing Breath of the Wild at all. And I think this has come up a few other times, but it definitely, to me, what struck me most quickly about it and kind of left the most impression was just that it feels different than other Zelda games. The controls are different. The physics are different. The feeling of, like, what your motivations are when you go out into the world, which is right at the very beginning of the game, you know. The things that might drive you to go try something different than what another person does. These things are not entirely new to Zelda, but they're being emphasized in a really different way here, and it was very exciting to me. You know, all the RPG stuff, I look at that and I'm a little skeptical that they'll get that right and that it'll really add to the game, but maybe it will. And if it does, it could really kind of change that series forever. So it was very exciting to me to get to experience that, even though, you know, it was over far too quickly.
I want to get your thought on ARMS, like some real, because that game, you know, watching the demo, watching the videos that we got out of Japan, there was that extended play session that was by far, as a connoisseur of Japanese awkwardness, the most awkward thing I've ever seen. I have no concept of that game, even reading people's like talks about it. Like, what is that game?
Well, it's too bad you didn't see the Treehouse Live demo of it, because it was very coherent, and I thought it sold the game really effectively, which is, you know, that's what it's there for. But my experience playing the demo at PAX was very similar to what I saw the Treehouse guys doing, except that they're a lot better at the game than I am. So, you know, there was a lot of me stumbling around doing silly stuff, but I thought ARMS felt pretty good. The motion control is a little weird because it's kind of like tank controls. You're moving both Joy-Cons to the left to make your character strafe to the left. But then I think you can also twist them a little bit to do some stuff. And then you put them towards each other to block. There's a lot of like trying to translate what I want the game to do into all these weird gestures. It was a bit distracting for me. Maybe I would get used to that with practice. But it was responsive. I'll say that. I got a little confused about how to do some of the commands that I wanted, but it was responsive and it was pretty fun. Like in the thick of the action, I was just playing against the computer. But in the thick of the action, I really was thinking about, okay, I'm not a fighting game player, so I can't say that I applied that sort of calculus to this at all, but I was thinking in basic strategy terms of, you know, how far away do I want to be from this guy right now based on what his superpower level is, you know, like how close is he to unleashing a special, how good is his throw move, how accurate is he with these punches that he's doing, and how accurate am I? Like, because if I'm too far away, I'm never going to hit him. So you kind of have to play with that stuff a lot. And I didn't catch his name, but the guy doing the demo for ARMS was really good and very, very helpful in kind of helping me latch on to what was happening pretty quickly. And it was fun. My favorite part about playing ARMS by far, and I thought this was intriguing when they first showed it, and it really comes through, is when you do that punch and then you can steer it, that's a cool feeling. It feels like you're in like a big mech suit and you're pushing a joystick forward to extend the mecha punch, but then you can steer it mid-flight like a guided missile, it's responsive. It feels good. Like, you can finesse it a little.
It reminds me of those old soccer games where when you unleashed a shot from far out, it took ages to reach the goal, and you could just put swerve on the ball afterwards. And so you're just shooting from a mile out. It's not even close to being on target, and then gradually swerve it back inside the post. That's what it looks like. Well,
so when you started talking about, you know, the control, what I immediately thought to, and although it's not super comparable, I immediately thought to that feeling in Zone of the Enders 2 when Jehudi is fully awake. Mm. And suddenly, like, you can just do whatever the fuck you want. You have this weird degree of control you just don't normally have in games, because you can basically put yourself any place on the screen with a button press.
Yeah.
Because it gets that warp. Like, that's the kind of just... There's just something cool about having that kind of just... Like, oh, I'm way more powerful now because... Fuck all reason, I can put this wherever I want.
Yeah.
And like that's the immediate... So the fact that you went to like a mech thing too is kind of amazing to me.
Yeah, well, the game has a little bit of heft to it in the way the characters move and the way the punches travel. And I think the speed of it is helpful. It was helpful for me in getting a feel for the control and how much I needed to, how far I needed to move my hands to make these gestures register and stuff like that. How hard do I need to punch? I think that stuff was generally helpful, but I do kind of wonder if this might be more fun ultimately if it was a little faster, a little more like Jehudi Type Zero or whatever it was called with the crazy warp dash. I mean, I tend to like my action games a little more fast paced, and ARMS is definitely a little more plotting. You know, it's a little bit more thinking about where am I going to try to lead this punch so that he goes that direction, but then I can sneak up. You can cross the streams with your punches. I mean, you can guide them to opposite sides, which has some value, you would think, in like misdirection and trying to fake out the... So, I mean, there's aspects of punch out, I guess, to it. I'd say more aspects of Wii boxing, which I'm not a big fan of Wii boxing, but I think it was interesting, and it was probably the one part of Wii Sports that I wish was a lot better, because I thought it had a lot of potential, and I never really saw anybody do anything with it. And ARMS, maybe with this arm extending thing, they've kind of solved some of the timing of it, so that there's no point in like just doing a flurry of punches. Like, you can't control the game that way. So they prevented people from doing what they used to do in Wii Boxing, and now you're actually thinking about where do I want to place this punch, and how do I make sure that I've got enough time to throw a block up? It's cool. I think of it as a boxing game, but it's a pretty smart, fun boxing game, and I do kind of like the characters. I'd be curious to see how many of those are in the game. Like, how much content is here really, or is it just jump in there and spar for a while? You know, like.
Yeah, I was originally kind of looking at it, and I thought, oh, they've decided they can't do Punch-Out again, so this is what they're going to do otherwise. But it doesn't seem that way. It seems much more, and I don't want to use the word esports, because you can go anywhere than that. But it seems much more focused on being a competitive game than say a Punch-Out replacement.
Yeah, It is definitely built, I think, for one-on-one play, which is, it's interesting to push a multiplayer game so hard at launch, but it is going to be online, and I bet what they think is that this, in conjunction with Splatoon 2, is maybe a way to get a lot of people playing online very quickly and sort of setting up a community that way. I don't know, but I would say one thing. ARMS does remind me of Splatoon in a few ways, of course, you know, other than just being a new franchise. But one thing I would love to see with it, just because I think the characters are fun to move around and the punching thing is just really cool, and you could design a cool single-player campaign for ARMS where you're solving puzzles and, like, trying to navigate through traps and things like that by punching around corners and, you know, doing all kinds of weird stuff like that. I don't know if the game is just going to have that kind of, you know, depth and content. But I would love to see that. I think it would be a good candidate for that kind of treatment. And it worked well for Splatoon.
It did. The thing about it that reminded me of Splatoon most immediately was I remember when Splatoon was announced, our first recording session back, I believe I made a comment, something along the lines of, it doesn't really look like a Nintendo-styled game. Mm. And this one kind of has that same thing. Like, it's not using their color palette, really. It's the artistic style is a little bit outside of their norm. Although it's closer than what Splatoon was. But you can definitely see that they're using different palettes now, different kind of styles now than they've used before. Nothing nearly as dramatic as human-shaped in the Mario World thing. But besides that, it's you know, there was a definite, like, visual style they've picked up in the last few years, and it definitely goes with that. And I wonder if that energy, you know, the fact that this is another competitive-ish game, you know, they feel like that kind of energy of visuals works well in it. You know, the bright colors will give you things to sort of see action on screen a little bit clearer. You know, high contrast, lots of bright colors makes motion more trackable. You're not gonna blend in with the background when you're hot pink and neon green.
Yep.
It is interesting that this game was on that, like, pick our last stage game for Evo, even though it's not gonna be out for until indeterminate time.
I saw that too. I thought that was a weird push from Nintendo to try to get people talking about it. I don't know how it fared in the voting. But
it did. I mean, it was one of those situations where there were a couple games on that list that were gonna roll. And it's hard because it wasn't just voting; it was based on donations. And so you're asking people to donate for a game they've literally never played.
Right. It's kind of versus a tough sell.
Versus like KI.
Yeah.
So it wasn't gonna succeed, but it was interesting that the Evo people even considered putting it up there, considering literally no one had played it. But I'm glad to hear it's got depth, because like that was my fear. Was everyone had the moment when they watched that thinking of Wii Boxing.
Mm.
And I don't want that again. I didn't want that the first time. but it's cool to hear that it's got real, like, player depth in it. I assume
finesse,
that
I think, is yeah, the word that makes me think it is about executing punches.
Did it feel like the people demoing it were just housing everybody?
Oh, they were mostly just teaching us how to play. They were trying to get people to play against each other.
Gotcha. Okay. Because yeah. I think back to, like, anytime I demo a fighting game at E3, just like I could tell immediately if the person was on the dev team or not, because you'd get in there and just get annihilated. Or if they at least were well trained on it. So any other games that jumped out at you that you really want to talk about?
On Switch, no, not really. I guess I could conclude just by very quickly saying Snipper Clips is really fun. I was playing it with a stranger, and it was a good sport, and you know, we worked well together. But I think it would be incredibly fun to play that with, you know, a close friend or a family member. It's deeply cooperative. It's very cute, and the puzzles are pretty fun to complete. Just even if you have a good plan, the execution of that plan is tricky, because you're doing it with another person, and sometimes you have to time, you know, be in the right place at the right time, or just, you know, the funny thing is that, like, even the shapes that you're trying to make are hard to describe, so it's difficult to get the other person in the right position, even if you know exactly what you want to do. That's fun. Really fun game. It felt, you know, immediately like something that Nintendo would want to produce, because it fits right in with the kind of the way that they think about how people interact with each other.
And this is kind of secretly like a really good push for Switch, because it's one of those, this game is, or this system is two player,
yeah,
right away.
It comes with everything you need, and you can download this game for a low price. So I think if Nintendo kind of approached it from that way, it might do them well. Honestly, it would be a good game to include with, like, I was thinking 1-2 Switch is really probably the game I would want included with an extra set of Joy-Cons.
it does have that Wii Play quality, and that's something that I think Greg alluded to last week.
Yeah, and I think it's better than Wii Play. I mean, the presentation of it is much more interesting. The mini games that I played worked well. The HD Rumble one with the box honestly was too difficult, I thought, because there's so much sensitivity in the little scenario that they concoct of this wooden box, which is three-dimensional, so you can even shake it and feel the balls moving inside the box. It's almost too realistic to actually count, because there's so many little interactions between the balls and on all the different sides of the box. It was wild. Right. It was a weird demo to show off that technology.
You've got our PhD. Any guess on how that thing works based on your experience with it now?
It's probably some kind of array of you know, little solenoid motors, or, you know, whatever they're using as a haptic actuator. It's probably laid out in an array, and I would think a 2D array, like across the Joy-Con, so that you can feel things moving. You know, like how Seren described it, is you can feel something moving across the controller. It's true, and it's impressive, because the controller itself is so small that there's not that much volume inside of it to really kind of have the sensation of something moving around.
But that's what I'm confused. Like, in my head, like, I've got engineering training. Like, in my head, I'm like, okay, if you were to start arraying them like that, well, wait, you run out of space. You run out of space almost immediately.
Yeah.
But maybe the small size actually makes it easier to simulate the effect.
I don't know. I mean, I think there's some kind of, like, you know, sensory trickery going on that's very clever. But the effect of it is very convincing. It's really neat to feel. But I do think that little mini game in 1-2 Switch, it felt like the advanced version of that game that we were playing. So I don't know if it was the best way to demo that technology, but I did spend I kind of stalled on choosing my answer for how many balls, because I just wanted to keep rolling it around and feeling it, because I'm just like, what is this? This is such a weird sensation. But it's cool, you know. I think 1-2 Switch just as a package looks really neat. I don't think I'm going to spend the amount of money that they're asking for it, but I would be very interested in picking that up sometime down the road, or maybe I get an awesome My Nintendo discount code for it. If I spend all my platinum coins.
30%, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe it really goes on sale, which would be amazing. Or at some point they decide to bundle it with Joy-Cons.
I think as a bundle it would be great.
They
could even add more mini games that take advantage of both people having a complete set. Right.
And that would be pretty cool.
That'd be a great way to kind of juice interest in that game around the holidays. But it's very cool.
Let me make a suggestion for a double Joy-Con game, because I've got one right off. I think it's really creative. All right, you both of you hold Joy-Cons at each side of you, and then someone yells draw, and you pull them up. You can email me. I'm not above taking job offers over email, so you can go ahead and email me for more of these hot takes.
I was thinking more like a game where you could use that IR camera almost as like a short dagger. So you had to like get that up against the other player. It's like a fencing game. So it could detect how close the controller is to the other person. And then maybe your other controller is like a shield. You can throw it up to protect yourself or something.
Oh man. The injuries will be amazing for that.
Yeah. That's why I'm not a game designer.
I want a whole Tumblr devoted entirely to 1-2 Switch fencing injuries. Oh.
Yeah, so it's you know, it's a system with a lot of different options, lots of different control stuff. The games that they're demoing so far there's a pretty good variety. I mean, you go from Bomberman to Street Fighter to Splatoon to ARMS to Zelda to 1-2 Switch. It covers a lot of bases, which is probably the idea. And yeah. You know, I think it's not a huge, beefy lineup, but there's plenty of interesting things in it. And, you know, Zelda for me is enough to make me want to buy that system anyway. ARMS, I'm keeping an eye on. Splatoon 2, sure. once that comes out later in the year, I'm down for that. And 1-2 Switch, you know, if I can get a good deal, that's something I would love to have on the system, just because you never know when you might want to do some cow milking or whatever. So yeah, it's I'm pretty pumped for the Switch now that I've, you know, I was pumped before I got to play it. I wouldn't say that my enthusiasm is dampened at all by the experience. I was pretty giddy for part of the time, and yeah, I think it's in a good position. So
cool,
I'm feeling pretty good about the Switch.
Excellent, Guillaume. I hear you've also been playing the new hotness.
Have I?
Probably.
Which one are you talking about? Super Mario Run?
I was making a joke about Super Metroid.
Super Metroid, yeah. Well, actually, like, we just spent a few seconds mocking my Nintendo Rewards, and we all had a good laugh. But guess who's been availing himself of some my Nintendo Rewards? This guy. I'm pointing at me.
Nice.
He's pointing at John, who's not here.
The more I look at the Switch, the more I think I might not be playing that system when I am out and about, you know? So that kind of... That's how I justify to myself buying Virtual Console games on 3DS today. Like, I'm thinking, well, I'm probably going to keep this system for a while yet, and it just might be, you know, a good idea to get some of my favorite Super Nintendo games on there. And there happened to be, 30% off on Super Metroid and Earthbound and Link to the Past, and I kind of went and got them all. But the one that I played is Super Metroid, and I realized that I might want to stick with beloved Super Nintendo games that are more RPG-ish and don't demand that you hold the X and B button at the same time if you want to charge and run, charge your shot and run, and then press A to jump, and then press like the shoulder buttons to aim up or down, and all of that while kind of trying to reach for the D-pad, which is actually quite low in the new 3DS XL.
Indeed. Because the thing about this on Wii U over here, if you remember, the Super Metroid on Wii U was part of the 30 yen, 30 cents, 30 pence, 30th
right.
Anniversary, was it? So you could kind of get it for nothing.
Sale.
Yeah, you could kind of get it for nothing, even though it was a Super Nintendo game, not an NES game, but for some reason certain Super Nintendo games fell into that. It was just a game a month, wasn't it, for the first so many months of the Wii U's life. And, you know, there were issues with it on the Virtual Console with Super Nintendo Wii U games because over here it was like the PAL version, so it was like frame skipping and some weird stuff and all that. But the one good thing about that was the customizable controls, you know, that you've got. You can reassign the buttons however you want. So it's kind of like, hey, you know, if you want to put running on one of like the back shoulder or something, which is the kind of thing that a modern game might do, you know, you could do that. And then it's not so awkward anymore. So, but that's the thing. New 3DS Super Nintendo games do not have that facility, do they?
Yeah. So you were... you just took over my new business. But yes, that's... indeed. So the Virtual Console, the Super Nintendo Virtual Console on new 3DS is bare bones. It looks good in
original resolution, but
it doesn't look good by default. You have to make it look good by choosing the pixel perfect mode. otherwise, it's smeared, and I'm not sure I understand the decision. Like, why would they make the slightly blown up graphics that are not, you know, that don't have an accurate resolution? I don't know why they made that the default.
Just because that's 4:3, and that was the original aspect ratio that people played it in. Whereas your original resolution is slightly narrower than 4:3, it would just get stretched on TVs at the time.
Right,
so
but
I guess
it looks like garbage.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's the easy tiebreaker for me. But yeah, I guess they went with the TV sort of tiebreaker, which, you know, you're not playing on a TV. it's not the aspect ratio of that top screen either.
Yeah. So this is all I don't know. This is all very disappointing after kind of the good work that had been done on the GBA Virtual Console and the DS Virtual Console on Wii U. We're back to, well, I guess we're not back to anything. The 3DS Virtual Console is as unexciting as it ever was. So, yeah, you can't assign anything to the kind of ZL or ZR buttons. You can't. There's no extra functionality. Like, literally, the only options are make this pixel perfect and also turn on or off the sending your data to Nintendo.
Yeah.
So, like, come on. But, yeah, so, unfortunately, I had to make the... I've always been comfortable on the Super Nintendo controller and, you know, on the Wii U, on the Wii Pro controller, whatever. I've always been comfortable with the default controls of Super Metroid. Some people would change them around, but I grew up playing with the default controls. But here, I just can't do it. And, you know, like, I'm not someone who complained about Kid Icarus Uprising controls. Like, I'm...
Well, you should have.
You mean, well, no, you're not a smart, rational person?
Anyway, I'm just saying I have a high tolerance for pain, I guess.
control eccentricity.
Yeah, but Super Nintendo controls on new 3DS don't really work. And I'm glad that John is not here right now, because I kind of feel him more now that, you know, like, he was complaining about Super Mario 3 and the D-pad and the 3DS.
Yeah.
Yeah, but so I understand him a little bit better now, but I also want to keep making fun of him, so I'm glad he's not here.
Look, how long have you been listening and slash been on this show, Guillaume? You don't need a reason to make fun of John Lindemann.
So I had to make the tough choice of going to the the in-game controller setting mode of Super Metroid, and yeah. I put the run button on the L trigger, and you can't replace the angle down that you lose by doing that. And I thought, well, I've seen some people on the internet say that it was still, like, a good way to play. Like, they're kind of converts. Like, that's what they feel most comfortable with. So I thought, well, I'm sure I can get used to it. And how often do you actually use the angle down button in Super Metroid anyway? Well, it turns out, like, a whole freaking lot.
Nah, it's the least used.
It's the least often, but I used it a lot. Like, as soon as you get the bomb... Yeah, I miss it dearly. Like, as soon as you get the bombs and you go left, like, you have that first wall that you have to bomb to keep going to Brinstar. There's this angled path, like, that you go down on, and if you can angle down your shot, you can just smash the fire button and run down all the way unscathed, and I can't do that anymore, and I miss it. Thankfully, I got the speed boost, yeah, very quickly, and so then, yeah, I'm going to be running through a lot of things.
In terms of, also, you know, there's the issue of the lack of customizability, you know, which is one thing, but it does speak to something we've discussed before, which is Super Metroid's controls are sort of suboptimal. You know, when you think about how much easier things seem to come off in the GBA games, which had fewer buttons, it makes no sense that they're as fiddly as they are.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I guess they didn't know better then, but we know better now. And yeah, I do miss, like, some sort of option to play, like, Metroid Fusion, where you just hold down a trigger and it angles up, and then you press down and it angles down. And it's a lot better than this.
Speaking of baffling lack of customizable button presses, I think assignments, I believe, because I remember James talking about Star Fox Command, playing that on the DS Virtual Console.
Yes.
I mean, it's kind of like, I think I said, like, oh, it isn't the controls customizable? And Joe said, oh, yeah, I'll have to go and check. And I'm pretty sure DS games do not have buttons. Which is bizarre when that has, like, about 8 different display options. It's like, you can have it vertical, you can have the touchscreen big and the upper screen small and vice versa and all this, and it's like, well, you know, if I'm going to be holding it, like, in a whole different orientation, wouldn't it make sense to have some discretion over what buttons do what? I don't understand why some of these things are not standardized. It's the bottom line here.
Yeah, that's one other thing that kind of allowed me to convince myself to get Super Metroid on new 3DS. Like, we haven't seen much about the Virtual Console on Switch, and I kind of feel like they're going to screw it up. So I can't really I can't really get too excited. I just can't get too excited about Virtual Console on Switch right
well,
now.
Well, it's definitely one of the biggest mysteries remaining, I think.
Yeah.
And it seems like they're going to have to say something about it before launch.
Yeah, but that's not to say that I'm down on Switch in general. Like, there's more and more and more games that I want to play, like party games or co-op games that just keep coming out. And I'm not going to buy a Switch at launch, but it's going to be difficult. I'm going to want one. I'm not going to have one. But anyway, so that's my Super Metroid adventures. Like, I can still play the game, and I the last thing I did was probably get the speed boost, but so I'm still early in the game. I haven't lost like my hands haven't cramped, like I haven't lost a fingernail or anything, hasn't fallen off, so I guess it's good enough. Yeah.
Just say no to delamination.
So the other thing I've been playing, and I'm still not gonna talk about it in depth because I haven't been playing it recently, but we need to say something about Super Mario Run. So I have played that a little bit on Karen got an iTouch device for Christmas, so I've been borrowing it. And so the deal is that she's been playing the story mode, and I keep going into the rally mode, which is kind of you go try to beat some stranger's high score, and then when you win, you get like various colored toads, and those toads are kind of unlocking things that allow you to then buy stuff for kind of a build your Mushroom Kingdom kind of mode. So Karen is taking care of that. She's taking care of story mode, and I'm doing rally mode. And I was Toad Rally, and I was enjoying it a lot at first. Like the game is well made. Like, it's a good Mario game. You would think, I don't know how Nintendo managed to just like kind of almost seamlessly take their skills and their experience designing levels for Mario, and then like, okay, yeah, he's always going to be moving forward, but that's no problem. Like, we can still make, you know, interesting and cool stages and put interesting challenges for people in there. And like, they did it. Like, it's hard for me to pinpoint exactly how these levels are well designed, but it's like, I'm always kind of amazed, like, when I face someone in Toad Rally that has a much better run than I do. Like, sometimes I look at their ghosts, I'm like, oh, okay, I had no idea you could even go there. I had no idea, like, oh, okay, that makes sense. Like, here, you can wait, and you can wait for this, like, better opportunity on this kind of block that you can pause, and then, okay, I didn't see, like, that unlocks an entirely new path that I was not aware of until
the,
now.
The most interesting thing I've seen with Mario Run, I haven't played it, but I've seen some videos online and stuff, is the whole thing of, like, because you got, like, spare lives, but you can kind of deliberately spend them to, like, bubble up and go back, and then get, right. So, like, if there's, like, a fork in the road, you can actually, you know, if you haven't wasted your lives elsewhere, you can sort of go down one path, then, you know, bubble up, you know, jettison that life, go back, and then go up the other path, and then obviously, you know, your score is going to be better as a result. That's a very clever little sort of weaving in of the lives with this actually sort of the scoring system.
Yeah, when you fall into a pit, you don't actually die, you go in a bubble, you do lose a few coins, but sometimes it might be worth it. But then you have to, like, the time limit in single player, quote-unquote, is actually pretty limit, like, it's not high. Like, you don't have a ton of time to do that kind of stuff. So if you keep dying over and over again, you're not going to finish that level. Right. And at Toad Rally, well, you know, like, it really depends on who you're facing, like, but yeah, there are some interesting strategies that you can do there. The unfortunate thing is that this is, you know, a pay once and you unlock everything kind of game, which is good. I like that. But the whole kind of collecting toads to unlock things to, like, build your Mushroom Kingdom or whatever, it kind of encourages playing the same Toad Riley levels over and over again. And so I discovered very quickly that the airship levels, I was having a much easier time in them in general, and like people seem to not be very good in general at them. But I found a trick of you just keep multiplying your score when you don't touch the ground for a while. And so the airship levels that have a lot of cannonballs are very easy to just like, you know, stay up in the air and keep multiplying your score and just trounce the competition. So I kind of found myself, and also like it's one of the rare levels that just gives you every color of Toad at the same time. So I found myself just farming that level over and over again, playing against, you know, a succession of people that don't even have Miis, so you know that they're going to be easy to beat. and then at that point, I was not really... Well, you know, like the when someone does have his Mii created and tied to his My Nintendo account, and you know, like you know, they're a little bit more serious than the rest, so you just avoid them. You avoid playing against them. But yeah, so it just encouraged me.
Is that Guillaume's advice for life?
I'm just giving our listeners a tip, like just go for for the kids without.
Just don't try.
Yeah.
Remember, if there's a smaller kid at the playground, that's the one you want.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So I found myself kind of getting into bad habits playing Super Mario Run. Like at some point, like the game was not actually that much fun anymore playing it that way. And the game didn't seem to be doing much to challenge me to actually go seek out, like try to challenge myself against more skilled players. Because then like when you lose a Toad Rally level, you actually lose Toads.
Yeah.
So there's this big disincentive
to win
picking
levels?
Fights that you're not sure you're going to win. So, but apparently, since last time I've played, they've updated the game, they've added a few things, and one of the things they did is that supposedly you lose fewer Toads. So, when you lose. So maybe, you know, maybe that's going to fix it. Also, something that happened is that Karen got further into the main game, which unlocked a different airship level that I'm no good at. So, you know, my strategy now backfires from time to time, so that also helps. But yeah, like it's, you know, it's a solid game. I really find it really well done. I enjoy it, you know, certainly enough to pay $10 for it. Certainly enough to borrow someone else's phone who paid $10 for it. But what was your question, James?
I would say, would you say it's a well-made game, potentially involving professionals?
Yeah, well, yeah, probably even like better than that. You know, like I really enjoyed it, and I enjoy Toad Riley. I'm sure I would also enjoy the main game. But yeah, like it's got a few phone game-y things in it that I think are just to its detriment. And I kind of understand why Nintendo put that in there. They just wanted people to keep coming back to the game with the Mushroom Kingdom building stuff, but
it's lame.
It's not really working.
It's not lame. Yeah, it's not good enough to keep you coming back just for that stuff.
No.
James, I was just going to ask if you had played the other Nintendo mobile game.
So I just got clearance to download it, like as we were talking. So not yet.
Okay.
It sounds like Don has already beaten the damn thing. So it's probably not very long. Of course, he got in a while ago. So they were letting people in who had pre-registered for this digital product. So I couldn't get in because that's asinine. And so it kept telling me coming soon until just recently. Not really instead, because it just came out. This last week, I have been playing some non-Nintendo stuff, as I am wont to do recently. And I've been playing Yakuza 0, which is the first time I've been playing one of these PS4 games, actually, where I'm not just playing catch-up with people who have owned PS4s for a while. This game is badass. Like that's the only phrase I could use to describe it. Like it's, we use that phrase ironically on the show occasionally, but I'm just gonna describe what a play session of that game involved yesterday. These are the events that punctuated my day. Played for about 2 hours. I was playing as series sociopath Goro Majima. Now, this game is a prequel to all of the previous games. It's set in the 80s, the late 80s, when Japan's economy was on fire.
Oh, yeah. So that Black Rain action.
Yeah. And basically these pleasure districts. And I don't like that phrase. A lot, when I was in Japan, a lot of like English guidebooks use them, or red light districts. That's not really what they are. They're basically just like, oh, there's clubs here. Yeah, there's some adult establishments here. There's some, you know, there's a little bit of sketchy stuff. But there's also, you know, clothing retailers and like the Capcom bar and stuff like that. Like it's an entertainment district. And yes, there is some less savory, or we'll say less family friendly content to a
more
lot of these places.
More Yakuza like content.
Yeah, yeah.
Yakuza grade entertainment.
Yeah, and there's definitely some stuff where you're like, that might be a, that massage parlor is not about giving your back a good workout. and there are people on the street who, especially with foreigners, are like, oh, you want, and like the books are like, no, don't, even if that's what you're looking for, don't, there could be some shit going down once you walk behind into their office. But in general, you know, these places are full of tourists. So the one in Tokyo, Kamakicho, is basically where the series takes place. They created a fictional one, and by fictional, I mean they gave it a different name. And as I was walking around Tokyo, I stopped at one point with Carly and said, dude, that's the parking lot from Yakuza! Because it is exactly the parking lot from Yakuza, like, even down to the same number of fucking parking spaces. Like, they didn't try. This one takes place in that place in the 80s, and also in the Osaka equivalent. Like I said, series sociopath Majima has been exiled to Osaka. And so you're playing as him as he runs a hostess club, because that's his punishment. And what's really alarming is you're playing as known sociopath, and he's charming and witty and fun, and you're like, oh, this is unpleasant. Like, I don't want to like this man, because you know what he's capable of. But at the same time, my day playing as him, it's like 2 hours, I broke into a cult that was run by a hippie who was just making shit up as he went along, and rescued a girl. That involved breaking into the cult, taking a pop quiz on all of their ridiculous practices, and then beating the ever-loving shit out of a hippie.
So
I then...
A lot like Earthbound.
Yeah, a little bit. But the hippie was trying to essentially teach all of his female followers, his sisters, special techniques for getting closer to enlightenment. It was yeah.
You had to make him tame.
I murdered him with a sofa.
Yeah, we call that making him tame.
I then went on an extended date with someone that I met at a telephone club, which is essentially exactly what it sounds like. You pay to sit in front of a telephone, and then women call, and you try to arrange dates. I got involved in a side quest where I had to play a UFO catcher until I got exactly the right prize out of it, only to be told, actually, I want a different prize. I got involved in an extended foot chase with Yakuza where I played hide and seek with them, and ultimately decided, fuck it, I'm really good at the combat, and then beat the shit out of them for like 25 minutes. I spent about 15 minutes in a disco where Majima was crowned, quote, disco king. He then sung karaoke and then played tambourine along with the woman who runs the place. And then he got involved in some super serious drama shit, like melodrama, where he had to decide if he wanted to kill someone to get back in good graces. All of this dumb shit, and then punctuated by like this super serious emotional scene where you're like, oh, he's not a sociopath yet, so I actually have to care about him. What's amazing about this game, as it just heaps bullshit on you and crazy nonsense, is that the characters you're playing as are the only characters in the game who seem to be aware of the fact that none of this makes any sense. And they come dangerously close to breaking the fourth wall. Like, they'll look at the camera and have an internal monologue where they'll be just like, Oh, I actually forgot. And he also got stopped by a guy running around in his underwear who goes to various sex-related places 7 to 8 times a day because of his libido. And I think his name is like Well Libidoed Man. Mr. Libido. His name is like Well Libidoed Man or something like that. Hmm. Or Man with Strong Libido. And he's convinced you're like him. It's very weird. It's a very weird scene. More pressingly, though, it started a mini quest and I'm like, I don't think I want to follow this one. There's this sense you really bond with these characters because you're experiencing the dumbest garbage. And your character will look at the screen and have some kind of like amusing comment about what's happening. And then everybody else in the world seems totally unfazed by it. And I'm sure if you're on Twitter, you've seen the chicken scene, which I will describe as following. Series Messiah Kazuma Kiryu is bowling and he gets a turkey, which if you're not familiar with bowling rules, that means you got 3 strikes in a row. And he is awarded a prize by the woman at the desk. That prize for a turkey is, quote, a turkey. The scene grows black. It comes back to image. And he is staring at her at the desk. And there is a live chicken on it, just standing on the desk. At which point he remarks simply, it's a little fresher than I expected it to be. And she goes, yes, we didn't intend for them to be live. I guess they got the order wrong. And then he also points out, oh, also, it's a chicken. This leads to an extended series where she says, well, I used to work on a farm. I can go cook it for you. And he goes, we ought to kill
it. Yeah, but also, yeah, like she worked on a farm. So she's used to it.
She's used to killing them. Yeah. But he decides instead, after a long pause, that no, he's going to take it with him and make him the manager of his real estate business. And then you get a title card that says what this chicken's real estate skills are. Like, this game is fucking strange.
Yeah.
But in the most amazing way, because no matter what you see, no matter what you've seen about this game, some other dumb thing will happen. And, like, in one case, I dropped the controller and just stared at the screen because I was laughing so hard.
Yeah, this seems ideal for you, James. This seems like exactly the kind of game that you like. So I'm glad that you found it.
Here's the thing. The fighting in this game is actually really good. Like, it's gotten a lot better. One of my adventures with Majima was he stumbled across 2 breakdancing gangs who were clogging up the main bridge in this game's thinly veiled Dotonbori equivalent. And because they were having a breakdancing fight. And afterwards, basically
like
one of
beat
them
it.
Lost. Yeah, yes, exactly. And they wouldn't clear the bridge until one of them, quote, won the turf. Mm-hmm. And once it was over, he basically pronounced, that's badass! And then proceeded to learn to breakdance to kick people's faces in. Like, they were just breakdance fighting like you would in a movie. He turned it into a blood sport. And, like, it's like, oh, okay, that's what this game is. All right, I'm fine with that. As dumb as this game gets, and it gets so remarkably stupid, that it still delivers this kind of like really melodrama, really thick melodrama that works. Like you actually feel for some of these characters. And so you have these characters living in the cartoonist ass cartoon world. And yet the actual stuff they're dealing with is heavy and delivered in such a way that you think, oh, this is actually kind of compelling in its own right. If you took all of the bullshit out of this game and just put the story out there, it's still a compelling. It's actually a compelling dramatic narrative. It's even weirder playing this game, though, having been to these 2 places that it takes place in. Because so much stuff they just copied outright. In the Dotonbori, there's this bridge. And on one side of the bridge is all of these lit up buildings. These buildings that have like signs on them made of actual light bulbs. Because they're old. And they replicate that scene almost exactly. And then you turn the corner and there is this restaurant that sells crab with a giant mechanical crab on the side of it. And sure enough, that's exactly where they actually moved the restaurant a block. But besides that, yeah, it's the same. There's the American Man, which is a statue of Uncle Sam. They turned it into a clown, but it's got the same color palette. Like, they didn't do much to not make this place exactly the same. And having been to Japan now, there's like this weird sense of like, oh yeah, This is kind of like going on tour in these parts of Japan. Like, there's this weird sense of nostalgia for the trip that I get playing this game. I don't know. This game is like really kind of delightfully stupid. And, you know, you can just kind of do whatever you want a lot of times and just wander around and just see the town. And that's fun in and of its own right. It is an open world game in the Japanese style, which is a very different experience. You know, it's a tighter area. There's just shit to do. You want to go to the Club Sega in 1980s and play Hang On? Go for it. It's there. Go have fun. Yeah, this game is great. Earnestly great. Even if you think all the weird bullshit is just weird, you will struggle to not find something in this game that you fall in love with.
I guess the question at this point is not whether Yakuza is coming to Switch, but which Yakuza is coming to Switch. Unless Negoshi is bringing back Super Monkey Ball, which I would prefer.
They are done with at least Kazuma Kiryu. Like Series Messiah is done now. With 6, which came out right after I left Japan. Ishin might be a good choice. But I don't know how easy that would be to port. And I mean, they already put Yakuza 1 and 2 on Wii U, and that didn't do great for them. So.
No.
Greg.
So yeah, working on the new business backlog that we sort of accumulated through the Switchmas stuff and all that, during the Christmas New Year period, I had a chance to hook up my import Mega Drive on the relatively rare occasions that happens, mostly to get some casual games in with my brother and the old sports stuff that we used to play as kids, and then some other things I've gone back and got. Cheap off retro game stores and stuff like NHL 94. I think we rented one of those as when we were kids, but we didn't own one. So it's kind of discovering that and stuff. But in addition to sports games, the other thing about the Mega Drive, that I kind of missed out on as a kid was shoot 'em ups. So I've got a few. I talked about Thunder Force a while ago, and I willed that 3D Classics version into existence. And don't let anybody tell you any different. That's how it went down.
Be responsible with your power, Greg.
Yes, indeed. I've played a bit of that. But also, Gaiares is a Telenet early Mega Drive shooter. You know, the people that made... Valis, however the proper pronunciation for that is, that series. It's kind of a Castlevania style action game. It's one of their shooters. It's pretty fast paced, pretty difficult early on. I haven't really played enough of it to make a sort of solid judgment on it, but a cool acquisition I got off eBay. It is actually a Japanese game that just had a few sort of little differences put on the packaging to make it sellable in Europe. So it's sort of a Japanese game and sort of a European game. But of course, when you put it in a Japanese Mega Drive, it runs properly and all that. It's got a cool power-up system. I think it's probably the most obvious stick-out feature of it.
How does that handle the TV differences?
Well, basically, Mega Drive, that's the thing. Mega Drive games were, you know, they didn't do any PAL conversions. It just, you know, it was the NTSC game, and then if you put it in a PAL Mega Drive, then it just automatically slowed it down and stuck the borders on it.
Oh, so they did it at a system level.
Yeah, it was just, but that's the cool thing. If you've modded the cartridge slot, so, which is just, you know, a simple thing called like N64 style, so that the different shapes fit, then you can take, you know, the crappy PAL games that I had as a kid, you stick them in this Mega Drive, and then they're full speed, full screen. And, you know, so I don't have to go back and buy, like, the better versions of the games I had as a kid. They just play as better ones now I have a Japanese system. So, yeah, that's the upside of not doing sort of PAL conversion stuff, which, you know, obviously was a better experience at the time, but, you know, that you got weird stuff happening with, you know, with those then. Like, I remember it kind of affected the timing in Killer Instinct. I remember, like, Rare sped it back up, but it kind of screwed up the combo breaker system or something. You know, yep. There were things that you could run into with that. But you know, another Mega Drive shooter I had my eye on is a favourite of Retronauts, Ray Barnholt, I believe, Steel Empire. So this is like a steampunk shooter from the early 90s. You can play as a blimp, which is always a plus.
That sounds good.
Yeah, but this game came out at full like $30-$40.
Yeah,
so this is
where I'm going with this. So basically, yeah, I'm playing my Mega Drive shooters in addition to sports games over Christmas, New Year's, and it kind of reminded me of the fact, oh yeah, you know, there was a 3DS version of Steel Empire. They put it was actually ported to GBA, I believe, at least in some territories, you know, sort of about 10 years earlier. So yeah, for whatever reason, this has got a kind of a following, or you know, kind of has this ability to come back that certain other shooters at that time period just don't. I thought, oh yeah, you know, that'd be interesting. So I looked it up, and it was actually on sale at the time. It came out here quite a bit later than it did in the States, and at a somewhat lesser price to begin with. But then, yeah, this was on sale for like half of that, so it was under a £10 value, and well, you know, it's a lot cheaper than if I was going to get a car of it, and you know, all that kind of thing. So yeah, I'm pretty interested in this. But the frustrating thing is, and I feel this is just the purest form of vindication for NWR's review policies, is that when I wanted to read up on the 3DS version, all anybody talked about was the sodding price. You know, it was like, let's talk about the game a bit. And there's but is it worth $30 though? Oh, I don't know. And it's like, I don't give a fuck. I'm not paying that. Like, it really did vindicate the idea. Like, yeah, like, it might not be that forever. That should not be the fucking kernel of your review. You know, like, it was so kind of, well, this is nice and that is nice, but not really worth the price. You know, and it's like, that does nothing for me. That does absolutely nothing. But of course, this being an old game, you can just reach farther back and actually kind of look at reviews of the original game to kind of decide whether you think it's worth the price that it is, that it was being charged for. And so I eventually got it, and I like it. I've spoken plenty of times about what a sucker I am for sort of traditional pixel art games in the stereoscopic 3D. This obviously has been clean, you know, not exactly the same as the Mega Drive game, just taken into 3D the way that Thunder Force 3 is on that new Sega 3D Classics Collection in Japan. Yeah, you know, because I said it had already been kind of updated once for the GBA game, and I guess this is kind of based off that, but then cleaned up a little bit again. But it's still got that great crisp kind of look. The steampunk looks kind of, you know, quite different for shooters of that era. You know, quite good with details. You know, a lot of the ships have, like, you know, you can see like little gears grinding and sort of, you know, bits of steam shooting off and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's got a distinctive kind of style to it. Soundtrack's still pretty good. Again, not just the sort of copy and paste of the Mega Drive synth. You know, it's got a little bit of its own, you know, more sort of personalized kind of sound, but it still does sound sort of in that vein. I guess, you know, if you're a fan of the game, you might have just preferred it the original way, which probably should be an option, but it isn't. You know, you just get these sort of variations of the soundtrack. But design-wise, again, the big thing, yes, you could choose between these two ships, you know, a traditional sort of fighter plane and then the blimp. And that's the thing, these ships have life bars. It's not a one-hit kill situation. And naturally, the blimp, having the bigger hitbox and being sort of slower, is sturdier. You have more life bars to kind of contend with. And they can both shoot either left and right at will. It's just mapped to separate buttons. So, you know, that kind of changes the paradigm for the way the enemies come at you, the patterns and all that. Because at any moment, you know, well, you can shoot behind you, shoot in front of you, although sometimes it does actually scroll from right to left. Like, you know, there's a sort of escape sequence that does that, for instance. So, you know, I think overall, that level of flexibility that you get with the life bar and the ability to shoot either direction, in front or behind, it makes it kind of a lot more of a friendly experience than your typical kind of shooters of the era that tend to be more merciless. It's, I guess you could say, you know, it's something that's, it feels less directly kind of arcadey, as it should. you know, given its roots. But also, I guess, on the on normal, it's really pretty damn easy. You know, I didn't die till the very end of the game, and then I'd stockpile so many lives from racking up score that I could just kind of brute force it through the difficult stuff. The next difficulty up balances out much better. Still not particularly hard as shooters go, because I'm sure most people sort of associate sort of merciless difficulty with that genre. You know, that's a better balancing out. And then, yeah, the most difficult, the final sort of setting seems pretty tricky, actually, a pretty significant step up, and you get like little achievements and stuff for doing all the different difficulties. And you can actually pick which craft you use for each level. So you could say, well, you know, I like the sturdier craft in this case, but then, especially towards the end where it's about more bullets flying around and all that, you want the smaller hitbox and you have the quicker movement to kind of weave in between all these patterns and stuff. So it's, I think it's a pretty cool shooter. The only sort of the downsides of it, I guess, there's some recycling with bosses, and they're pretty damn bullet spongy anyway. You know, I mean, I guess they're kind of in the vein of when, you know, something maybe you might see in a UN Squadron kind of game where, you know, you've got a craft with a lot of, like, gun emplacements and all your kind of multiple aspects to shoot at in it, you know, and it just seems like everything takes a while, especially if you are going on the higher difficulties. I imagine they probably dial this up, you know, to shoot everything. Although it kind of, I think some of that is in place to reinforce the importance of this experience system that they've got in there, where you've got pickups. If you get three of these pickups that are just labeled with the letter P, that gives you a level up, and which just increases your firepower. There's nothing very fancy going on with the power-ups in this, is, you know, doubles and, you know, like missiles and like all this crazy, you know, it's not Gradius, or, you know, we get this ridiculously sort of overpowered arsenal over time and then it all gets taken away from you when you die. It's a lot more basic than that, but you do have this persistent level up mechanic from collecting those power-ups. So I guess if you get behind the curve on that for some reason, maybe you just miss a few because of the hecticness of what's going on the screen, the bosses seem even more bullet spongy as a result, perhaps. But I just think in general, that's kind of the way, yeah, they're not very kind of like heavy pattern intensive kind of encounters. It's kind of a little bit war of attrition-ish, and I'm not such a huge fan of that. And then you see them multiple times. So, you know, that's not the strongest part of it.
No, but in a shooter, that's a pretty terrible sin, because the bosses are so important.
Yeah, I kind of feel like this, you know, has got enough kind of going on in the regular flow of the levels that it doesn't feel like such a drag. That, you know, like I said, you've got, because of the enemy patterns coming from all around you, some of the scenarios which are kind of embellished with the 3D graphics kind of give a set piece feel. You know, I mean, one thing I've said before is that stereoscopic effects with side-scrolling games have the advantage of really being able to convey scale in a way that's quite difficult for pixel art, especially to do on its own. So, for instance, you're kind of in a cave sort of scenario, and you're going through these tunnels or all that, and then at some point you go lower down into the caves, and there's a sort of catacombs system behind you that is far, far deeper in appearance than it was higher up. So it really kind of gives you the sense that you've gone into this sort of vast cave network, having been in a relatively confined tunnel. And I just, you know, I'm not sure how else you could really convey that with pixel art without the usefulness of this stereoscopic effect. So that's kind of a cool thing. And then, like, the tall tunnel blows up and you're coming back the other way and all that. You know, it's got some cool kind of defining moments. But yeah, as a big boss fan, it's sad when they don't really kind of deliver, although like the last level is largely a boss encounter, and that's got some more interesting kind of wrinkles to it. So, you know, yeah, it's a cool shooter, a little bit different from your typical, you know, spaceship with gradually, you know, expanding arsenal kind of feel to it, both visually and in the gameplay. So, you know, if you're into this sort of thing and it's passed you by because of the price, you know, when it originally came out, keep an eye out, you know, in your region for if it might be coming lower or whatever, because I'm not that fond of playing these games on a handheld, but on the XL anyway, I managed it it was, you know, I felt like I had enough screen real estate and the you know, comfortable enough hold in the system with the D-pad and all that kind of thing that, you know, it worked pretty well. Wasn't a huge problem. But yeah, I will prefer, I think, having played R-Type on the gamepad with the virtual console, I and Switch has a screen the same size, I think I'd be happier for portable shooters on a screen of that size. Because, I don't know, it seems to really matter for me. Which also makes me think as well, John was talking about his accessories last week. The dream accessory for me with Switch has got to be a stand which, you know, turns tabletop into Tarte mode. Exactly. This is the console. You know, your Kid Icarus style bundle with the stand in, and then, you know, this is the console for Tarte. I want to see every vertical shooter going on this thing. It's almost infinitesimally small possibility that it will lead a Tarte mode renaissance, but, you know, your man can dream.
You know, Hori might just do that for reasons.
Like, yeah, they might do it. I just don't know there'd be any games to bloody use it.
You can play Breath of the Wild in Tarte mode.
Although, having said that, there is like some, I think it's called Ghost Blade. There's like a bullet hell shooter coming out on Wii U in relatively soon for some reason. So hope springs eternal.
God. Well, that's going to do it for new business this week. And I wanted to thank Johnny for joining us. He's gonna head out. He very graciously offered to give us some Switch impressions.
And I begged to be on the show, and you allowed me. So thank you for having me.
That was hardly a beg.
I'm gonna jet. I got things to do. But it was great fun, and I'm excited for Switch, and you know, I'm sure I'll get to talk with you guys some other time about more Switch and Nintendo stuff.
Yep, absolutely. Well, we'll look forward to it. And on that, we are going to take a break, and we'll be back for some amount of listener mail. Stay tuned. And we're back with listener mail. As I mentioned in the previous segment, Johnny had to step out. But we're still here, and the inbox will always be here until the heat death of the universe at rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. I'm hoping that comes on like next Wednesday. So you can send us your questions or deep thoughts or theories for how the world will end to there, like these people did. Guillaume.
David writes, "Hello, RFN. I have been playing Rhythm Heaven Fever via the eShop Virtual Console. Since my first Rhythm Heaven game was Mega Mix, I find Fever to be kind of difficult. As I struggled through Monkey Watch, Love Rap 2, and the quick-paced Final Remix, I thought about HD Rumble. My question is, what can HD Rumble add to the Rhythm Heaven series along with rhythm music games in general? A Rhythm Heaven minigame involving ice cubes comes to mind. Thanks, and keep up the good work."
So I will say that Monkey Watch is a real bastard.
Like, I love it when it just starts doing the crazy zoom in, zoom out.
That's
why you close your eyes. You just go with the flow.
You've got to use the force, by which I mean your sense of timing.
that one in particular is one of the eyes closed games, because that game is a bastard.
But that is exactly the thing. I think there's two ways that you could look at HD Rumble with this. Number one is embellishing, you know, what's there already, like that you see in Rhythm Heaven games. So one that I thought of specifically from Fever is, I think it's called in English, because again, I play these in Japanese, so I think something like Package Pests or something. It's the one, I think it features heavily in that Final Remix, I think he's referring to there, where, you know, they're throwing you sweets, but then they also throw you spiders, and you've got to catch the sweets and slap the spiders away. And it's like, especially like if you catch a spider by mistake, you see these sort of squiggly lines around the hands and them trembling like,
yes.
And that's that you could really embellish stuff like that with the HD Rumble, I feel like, you know. but then you could also do stuff where it's kind of like, okay, another sort of device that Rhythm Heaven will do sometimes is just have you, like, say, for instance, if you're, you know, whatever it might be, hitting baseballs, hitting golf balls, catching whatever, just they sneak something different in. Like, right. The timing isn't different. It's just something visually different, and it's there to screw with you.
It's like, again, a rabbit's head on the baseball ones.
Yeah, so, okay. Yeah, it just zooms in and out, and it's like, it's head's changed or whatever. Again, like, yeah. the rumble there could really kind of be another way of, like, screwing with you. It's like, oh, yeah, actually, you know, this ball that we just threw at you is Velcro. Also, you know, like, just to really kind of have another layer. So we talk about the kind of audio-visual kind of alchemy that goes on Rhythm Heaven, where, you know, at its heart, it's really kind of simple. You could do it with your eyes closed, but, you know, they kind of have this way of tricking you into sort of, like, relying on the visuals, and then they pull the rug out from under you. And then, you know, if you kind of do that with rhythmic feedback as well, it could be sort of another layer to that experience, which I think kind of defines what Rhythm Heaven is and why I like it.
Well, yeah, and the dark thing in Monkey Watch is the go-to for this one. We said, oh, just close your eyes, but they sneak the pink monkey in there. The pink one's the regular one. They sneak the one with the sunglasses in, which you have to go off rhythm on.
Yeah, instead of the regular slap, it's like the double
slap. Right, which means you have to, like, you kind of have to watch. And so they could do shit like that where it's like, I'm just going to ignore the rumble. I'm going to ignore the rumble. Oh, but I have to pay attention to it because that's giving me vital information I need for the next. Like, it's part of Rhythm Heaven and Fever, especially once they were sort of freed in terms of presentational stuff.
Yeah, they could do way more fancy presentation stuff than they did on DS and GBA.
So part of what makes that game work particularly well at being deceptive is the ability to just essentially give you sensory overload. There's so much going on, both audio and visual. Your brain starts to get almost tired. Like, there's just so much happening.
Well, also, it starts to make, like, connections which you don't necessarily have to be true, you know, like, so right. Another good example is, like, there's always a samurai slice game in a Rhythm Heaven game, you know, and then they start, like, the dark clouds start coming across the screen and obscuring, and again, I mean, it's like, nothing's changed in terms of the cue from that. Nothing has changed at all, but you start kind of feeling unsure because, you know, you're so used to the connection of the visuals and the sound that just altering one, even though you could continue to go by the sound alone, throws you off. And like that, you know, the rumble part just could add that extra layer to it. I think it's a really interesting idea and just something that kind of fits, has a natural kind of fit, you know, with the whole thing, the beat being such an important part of any rhythm game. It just, I feel like the possibilities are there.
Yeah, the question of using the HD rumble to make the rhythm game as a gameplay mechanic, that seems more like a 1-2 switch thing. Where you know, they would basically, like, you can do something like it pulses out a rhythm and you have to tap it back to it or something like that. Almost like Let's Tap-ish. Where you have to do something in response to the rhythm.
In the end, I think that the heart of Rhythm Heaven is always like, look, the music, and the sort of little tutorial that you go through before you actually go into the game proper. Like, that's all you ever really need. But then this other stuff is the fun embellishment. So I don't think it should go beyond that, you know, like, I don't think it should get to a point where it's like, yeah, that's what it's about kind of thing. Like, you know, judging the rhythm from the feedback or anything like that. You said that's kind of a different game, right. A mini game unto itself or something, but the embellishment part could definitely work.
Yeah. If they do the whole barrage of light and sound that they do in some places, especially in Fever, and then add like complex rhythm pulsing in your hand, your brain is not going to be able to handle it. That's going to be some Because you're going to have to be filtering out two of the three senses the game is giving you.
Another thing that could be quite interesting, actually, would be if, for instance, because obviously usually it doesn't need much in the way of button. You know, there was only two inputs in FIFA. Yeah, there was right. A and B together. That
which
was
is, we still make jokes about being weird.
Yeah, the pinch. That's I always think of it. But, you know, you could have one of the things that was nice about FIFA being a console game, in theory, is not something I ever got to do. It's the notion of people watching this madness.
And it's crazy.
But the thing with the two Joy-Con, you could have somebody playing the game, you know, sort of feeling it a lot. But then you could have someone watching just kind of holding a Joy-Con. And so they could kind of feel it with you. You know what I mean? Like experience it with you. They get the full kind of sensory experience that you're getting and all the kind of silliness. Like I said, of, you know, you imagine a game where you're catching a bunch of different stuff and they all feel different, even though it's just the same thing. You know, so their feet, you know, it matches the images on screen. And all that, it would kind of enhance, it could enhance that spectator component that FIFA had as well.
Yeah, the spectator thing is real. Like watching somebody or really taking turns trying to clear Remix 10 or trying to clear it with the high ranking was you know an experience, because you'd have this moment of like, oh, she's gonna do it, I don't want her to do it.
I want to do it first. Just not like the controller ever.
In the back of your brain, you're like, she's doing it, she's doing it, she's doing it. I don't want this to happen. I don't want this to happen. But at the same time, you're excited. And then it's just something. Like you're caught up and you'll see that they stumbled on one of the change-offs.
And sometimes once she's like, especially with something kind of relentless, like one of those final remixes can be, only takes one thing to kind of throw you off rhythm, and then even stuff that hypothetically you should be able to do without much trouble can go wrong as well. The high wire act.
I don't really remember. There were two player games, weren't there?
There were, there were some. Yes. I never got a chance to play them.
Right. I think that I tried with Karen and we quickly gave up. But
they're fine.
And there's two player Mega Mix too, but of course that is, you know, requires like, you know, two systems and I think it's download play. I know that you need another card, but it's obviously it's easier with something like Switch or Wii for people to gather around and enjoy it that way.
Right.
We did the if we did multiplayer, it was almost certainly the wrestling one, because there's something about seeing two wrestlers on screen doing the interview that makes it even dumber. But it really, they had a bunch of rhythm games that were two player, and that was really the more focus of the multiplayer. It was like there was the one that basically was the martial artist kicking stuff. I just can't remember what it was called. They actually created these like kung fu movie characters for this one. I can't remember what they called it. Beyond the core gameplay, I think it was a rhythm game in one of them.
Yeah, like you have these kind of rhythm toys. They call them sometimes, you know, like these kind of sort of high score games. So they had the whole like pachinko thing in Mega Mix, didn't they? With the vegetables and the goat and all.
Yeah, it was weird.
You get sub game kind of stuff, but I think of, you know, it's for the main stuff that you really think about these sorts of applications.
Yeah, I mean,
it'd be nice if they could like find a way to get multiplayer like even more into the series. If it did come to Switch, like I think that would be more the tendency. You know, of course they did that with Wii, I think, because of, you know, the console experience. But yeah, I think I've heard some good things about the multiplayer in Mega Mix. I just don't know how many people would actually get to do it. I mean, I had an import copy, so that was a total non-starter.
That would be a fun just addition to the Switch as this multiplayer centric device, because you couldn't effectively do this game online multiplayer because it wouldn't work. I mean, you could potentially make it work literally, but so much of that is about presentation, about being in the moment with another person, that I just don't think it would be effective. It'd have to be more of just a score attack thing, and even then, that's not particularly enjoyable. I don't know. I'll be just happy if we get a new, like a full new Rhythm Heaven without a story mode.
Yeah, we talked about this before, I think, but the whole thing, you had Sun Ku's health problems and all that. I don't take it for granted that the series would continue, you know, kind of the way it had up until, you know, Megamix, which I like it a lot. It's a great thing to have as a Rhythm Heaven fan, but it's not like an entire new game in scope compared to the others. Although I think kind of what David talks about, kind of Megamix being easier, I think that's got a lot to do with the lower screen timing thing, you know, that you can actually see whether you're late or early with that, you know, sort of firework thing going on to actually visualize your kind of where you're coming in. I think that probably made a pretty big difference in making it easier for people. But yeah, I don't see how you could kind of easily replicate that without the lower screen being free.
All right, Greg.
Yes, so Ty writes, "Hey RFN crew, with the Switch getting closer to launch and the launch lineup growing, what is one game series that you would like to see come to the system that's not yet been announced? Whether it's a Nintendo game or a third party, what is that one series you'd like to see on Switch, and what do you think are the chances of it showing on the system? Love the show, keep up the good work."
Anybody have something burning? Yeah, well,
Rhythm Heaven we've addressed, and that's up there, you know, because I do really want to see the series continue, and I think, as we've discussed, there's some interesting possibilities there, but yeah, we've also got a lot of other ones. I mean, this Bomberman thing is interesting to me, because I've barely played any Bomberman in my life. A friend of mine had the GBA Bomberman, which was that a launch title or just a really early game? Was it, I remember playing...
It was very early. I know that.
Playing
much.
some multiplayer through the link cable at school with my friends in 2001. Like that's pretty much the limit of my Bomberman experience. But the fact that Konami is willing to do that with their Hudson, holdings, kind of excites me about, like, could they bring back some of their own stuff? Could they bring back other Hudson stuff? Like, thinking a bit, you get to a point where you kind of give up on some of these Japanese publishers, like, reaching into the back catalogue, but it's like, if they could bring a Bomberman back, is it so out of the question that Castlevania could yet rise from the grave again, or anything else? I don't know. It's I'm glad that it's something other than just, you know, Pro Evo and Metal Gear from that publisher. I think that's kind of exciting in and of itself.
Yeah, even companies like Capcom, where you look at what they're making and you go, well, what about your old stuff? And the thought that maybe that we'll see some of this stuff come back is heartening. I refuse to allow myself to get excited about the prospect of Mega Man appearing on anything.
Oh no!
I've been hurt before, and I'm not willing to let it happen again. I'm still...
I just love the idea that James waking up every day to his phone saying, Mega Man! From the Smash. I live and dies Mega Man every day.
Every day I give it thought, I go, you know, we almost got Mega Man Legends 3. And then I get sad again. I get real sad, and then I go on with my... I go on and I see the picture of the new Mega Man cartoon and I want to die. I want to die on the outside like that picture made me on the inside. he's Mega Man, but he's in high school and he's got another little Mega Man inside of him that's actually controlling him, because what? What the fuck? Oh. God, what a disaster. No, I think if it was a series that I would want to see on the Switch, I could cheat and just go like, I want to see Ogre Battle on the Switch. But like, fuck, I want to see Ogre Battle live.
As I said earlier on, I want like some vertical like treasure to be able to do a vertical shooter again. But it's like so infinitesimally unlikely. It's pretty much not worth mentioning, you know.
For me, if I were to try to justify it, I would justify it in that game. Being able to play that game wherever I wanted would be nice. You know, being able to just step away from my TV or play that game while I've got something on TV, because that game is infinitely waiting. Like there is a tremendous amount of I have set the pieces in motion and now I sit here and wait for them to do stuff.
And then end up playing Hungry Hungry Hippos, right?
Something like that. I would say for something that's more realistic and actually better tuned towards what the Switch is, I struggled a little bit on this one, but what I'd really like to see is I want to see some of the you know, the DS era stuff that we got. And that leads me back to Capcom. And it really does. It kind of leads me back to, you know, I want to see stuff like Mega Man Zero on this thing. I want to see what that kind of art style looks like. Actual, you know, pixel art in 2017 on a screen like that would look like. And the indie games are kind of giving us that, but Inti Creates is giving us almost that, but not quite. And I just want the real thing. I don't want...
Well, yeah, so they're doing Blaster Master Zero on 3DS, aren't they?
They are, and of course they did the two Gun Vaults.
Right. Yeah, Gun Vaults and Mega Man 9 and 10, and yeah, so, I mean, yeah, those style of games they could do. I mean, they do some footage of that Blaster Master recently out of Japan, wasn't there? They've put the frog, the goofy frog storyline is now in the Japanese version. So it's canon now, Fred or whatever, the frog. It's canon.
Why not?
It looks pretty cool, you know. Yeah. And I'd give them the bigger canvas, you know, of a Switch might be interested, although of course, you know, you gotta wonder about, like we talked about before, like the kind of dying art of pixel art and why, you know, people are using other methods to make 2D, right. Or even people are way forward, you know, with the most recent Shantae and stuff. So yeah, I don't know how, again, it's like not the most
powerful
thing,
really, but
just the play style would be cool to me to see them do something on Switch.
I mean, the art in Mega Man Zero is so good.
Very nice.
And to see it done now would be unbelievable. I understand that would be expensive as hell to make. Maybe if they use the same kind of tech that Guilty Gear is using right now, where it's not actually 2D, but it sure as hell looks like it.
They kind of fake it, yeah, and it looks good, you know, for doing that. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Shantae, from what I haven't played the Half Genie Hero, but it looks beautiful, I mean, from what I've seen.
But I don't want your 3D models that are clearly 3D models running in what's clearly a 3D stage. Like, that's not what I'm here for.
Could you be alluding to Mighty Number 9?
Mighty Number 9. What about you, Guillaume?
I really want Skip Limited to do something that's not a 2D platformer. So
what about an honest-to-goodness Chibi-Robo game again? You know, an actual...
Yeah, I think that falls into the unrealistic,
probably
the sky kind of thing. No, I'm thinking more like, so back when DSi was a thing and WiiWare was a thing, and, you know, back when Nintendo had platforms for downloadable games that were not good, these guys were firing on all cylinders, just like giving us really, really good games, like art style, the art style series, like Pictobits, Bug's Life, like they were cool concepts. They were cool games. They made, in my opinion, a DSi worth owning. They made, you know, a lot of good stuff for WiiWare. And now that Nintendo has viable online eShops and stuff like that, like they're nowhere to be seen.
Yes,
Skip Limited is nowhere to be seen. And I, you know, like we've got all these. I look at the Switch right now, and really what makes me want to pick one up is all the indie stuff that we're getting. But I, you know, I want Japanese games as well. I want, you know, I want Skip Limited. I want maybe arts remakes of the art style games, and I want to see new concepts from these guys.
Yeah, similar things. Which Pictobits was new for DSi, wasn't it? That was not one of the bit generations that just came back.
I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it looks like.
I don't think Bucks. Which ones were?
Bug's Life wasn't Bit Generations either. Bit Generations was art style light tracks. was originally Dotstream. Orbient was originally Orbital. But right. Yeah, you had the original ones too, like the Pentatentacles.
Base 10. Zengage, yeah. Which I didn't really like that much, but some other people liked it. No, like they made really great stuff, so I miss those guys. So that... Yeah, that's what I want to see.
I've said this before when we talked about, you know, the already sort of mooted Pikmin game, that a lot of the focus is going to be on the fact that you can do co-op because you just snap the Joy-Con off. That's that. But I really like the idea of a Pikmin handheld style multiplayer where you're actually wirelessly networking multiple systems because you can have independent views of what's going on. And that, I think, is something that could be really, really cool in a multiplayer Pikmin game. But of course, up until now, you probably haven't had a handheld with the power or the resolution to do Pikmin justice. But certainly from what we've heard, you know, 720p and the quality of the screen and all that, I don't see any issue here with Pikmin. I mean, just like playing Pikmin 3 off TV on the gamepad screen was doable with the touch controls when they patched those in. So, yeah, you kind of extrapolate that out, and I think you could have a really, really fun kind of multiplayer experience with Pikmin that you haven't had before by virtue of the fact that you can do it in that sort of handheld style and still have the experience hold up. I have no idea whether that's what they're pursuing, or, you know, whether they'd kind of extend that to online, which you could, but they might not. Or, you know, but I feel like it's something that you could take, a place you could take Pikmin, you know, that they haven't before, because you know, Pikmin 3 is really, really good, very, very good, and the multiplayer apparently is quite fun. But I guess, you know, it's a little bit hamstrung by the sort of split screen. Is it split screen when you do the battle bingo thing? Because I haven't really tried it.
You know, I don't remember. The co-op, I played split screen, but I don't think I played the battle bingo that much.
Yeah, it's supposed to be really fun. Like, I've heard some good things about that, but never had the chance to try it out.
Yeah, well, Karen doesn't. And I don't really like competition as much as cooperation.
The competitive aspects, but yeah. I think to be fair with Pikmin, I think the biggest potential is in the co-op stuff as well. Yeah, you know, it's a game about multitasking, so there's a natural extension to multitasking, not just with yourself, but, you know, right, actually with another player.
Multitasking with yourself, that's the episode title, or
I'm sitting on one right now, but maybe what one thing that we talked about it a couple times now. You know, an Advanced Wars game. Advanced Wars Living.
Look, you could go through the list of just ones, you know, Advanced Wars, Metroid, F-Zero, like ones I want to see come back. You know, and I guess the question is, you know, what is most suited to the format, or what is just most ripe for a comeback? You know, and I guess Advance Wars is, you know, it's interesting that we've kind of joked about the whole popularity of Fire Emblem, like, killing it, but is there a chance it actually helps?
From the makers of Fire Emblem, potentially, I think there's some presentational stuff that they might apply from a Fire Emblem series in. I mean, there's no reason why, I mean, the thing is, it's not as character focused, and that certainly has been to Fire Emblem's boon. But it certainly has given them flexibility to do other stuff, I would imagine. Or perhaps it hasn't. Perhaps it's enslaved them eternally to the Fire Emblem throne. But
yeah, that's because, I mean, you know, we talked about the scope of Fates, and now we've got another remake coming, and then there's, you know, the Switch game, you know, supposedly is going to be next year. I mean, that's quite a clip. You know, just for that, so you wonder how much of their, you know, focus is occupied with that now, and so it may very well be to the exclusion of something like Advance Wars. But, you know, at least it's, you know, turn-based strategy, you know, getting kind of exposure, so, you know, rather than just being kind of left as this quirky little side thing, you know, something that's shifting millions of units. You know, so,
but you could say, but I mean, it's something that would work being taken portably or on a TV as well.
Yeah,
yeah. Maybe as, I don't want to say budget game, but as less less invested in than a Fire Emblem Awakening.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, we've talked about this before, that, you know, the weird thing about Switch, and, you know, if it does prove to be kind of the unified Nintendo platform, obviously at the moment they're still talking about, oh, you know, 3DS is... it's going to be around, and
they're almost saying it too much.
There might be a successor to the 3DS, Kimishima said recently. You know, they look at those possibilities, which of course, yeah, I mean, they're always looking at, yeah, they always develop prototypes and things of hardware that never see, you know, the marketplace. So that's, you know, nothing terribly revolutionary, but if I think we would agree that if the Switch succeeds in the, we're certainly to the level of being as successful as Wii, which is something that Kimishima
has said
he expects, which is, I mean, I know you never want to talk down your own product, but there is a line where, you know, you kind of seem delusional, but leaving that aside, you know, I feel like these situations where, you know, however big it gets or whatever, you need to have a range of software in terms of the pricing for this kind of platform, where it's going to be kind of the handheld experience type of stuff, smaller games that Guillaume talks about that you could have from people like Skip that are downloadable, and then, you know, the big Zelda type stuff. We don't really know in practice how well some of these kind of mid-level games are going to survive on it. Will it be totally polarized between the big blowout games like a Zelda, Breath of the Wild, and then the little indie games, and then the stuff in the middle is not, there's not really space for. You know, I mean, it's interesting with Bomberman, going back to that, the whole price of that. You know, there's been kind of disbelief about, you know, what the retail price apparently is of that. You know, it's pretty much a full price game. Of course, we do not know what the scope of the game, you know, we haven't played it, so it's not as if you can really judge the sort of content or that, but it does seem like it's the kind of thing be better served by being a mid-tier kind of product. And maybe that would be true of something like Advance Wars 2, but we just don't know how well that can survive in this marketplace yet, because we haven't, I know that we've seen, you know, such a disparity in, right, you know, kind of the scope of like packaged software. We've had the disparity, you know, with digital games at this point, sure, but with games that would actually come on a card like that, like you're presumably in Advance Wars would, I don't know how comfortably are they going to sit, you know, can we have $30-$40 games rather than the full $60 stuff sit happily on shelves?
Is it maybe that they don't sit on shelves? Is it maybe that we start seeing the $30 online? I mean, they've already started conditioning to us with Rhythm Heaven. Games like
that's a good point.
Just said, we're not going to put these on shelves. It's $30 and online only, fucking deal with it.
But it's an interesting point, because I mean, it's one thing with series like that, but we talked about it when we had a question about Zelda before, and like how they're going to handle it, and we say, oh well, you know, these humongous ambitious games, they come out once every 5 or 6 years, but there's all these other games that are smaller in scope,
right,
that come out much more regularly, and it's like, well, okay, well, so if the next Triforce Heroes Link Between Worlds game comes along, which we kind of expect it will, because you want to keep that Zelda product coming out, and, you know, can it be a Switch retail game that's $30? You know, like, can that happen? Or is it maybe, like, well, if it's Zelda, we can't devalue the brand and have that be like a budget thing. So no, that can't. But like, would you do a digital only Zelda game? It's you know, none of this is like completely implacable or anything, but it's just, we haven't seen an ecosystem, you know, for Nintendo games that would have that kind of range on it, and so we don't know whether maybe certain things will get squeezed, and it will make it less likely that we see some of these franchises.
HAL kind of did something kind of like that with their Kirby games. Like they had Triple Deluxe, and that had mini games, and then they released the mini games standalone, and probably, yeah. I haven't played them, but I haven't played the download versions, but I assume they added some content to them, and then they did.
This is Fighters, Kirby Fighters EX and DDD's Drum Dash EX, I think they were, and they certainly did add, yeah, because they were very slight in the triple deluxe package.
Right.
And then, yeah, they kind of embellish them to sell them as separate games.
Yeah, so I don't know how that worked for them, but I don't know. It seems to be kind of a... They tried that idea.
So the one thing I will say is, and we've seen some indie games doing this just recently, release digital, do better than expected, release physical.
And then scale up, to the retail.
So, I mean, they could do the, here is the digital game, it costs $25.99 or whatever bullshit price they're going to set it to. And then if they feel like a game has been a big success, maybe you release some full retail release, and then when you wind up for the sequel, you do have a retail release.
Yeah, so I mean, yeah, that's it. Maybe with some of some of these franchises we talk about, maybe bringing back like an Advance Wars or something, that could be the pathway. You know, like start digital and see how it goes.
Right.
Although it's worth mentioning, like with the Rhythm Heaven example, like that was the case in America, but it was not the case in Japan and Europe. They still went physical. Whereas yeah, maybe with something like this, it would have to be digital across the board. I mean,
so yeah, with Advance Wars, they'll probably release it here and then release it like through My Nintendo alone as a reward in Japan.
Yes.
You know,
that's basically what happened with Days of Ruin, wasn't it?
What happened.
It never got released properly, you know, at retail, even though it was a game developed by a Japanese studio, presumably in Japanese, and then localized to America and
what
Europe.
The
that's crazy. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's just that's the thing that really takes the hope out of you for Advance Wars, some extent. It's just the idea that, you know, that had this really rich history in Japan, going back to Famicom Wars, it was on Game Boy, Super Famicom, and then GBA, and that's when it started coming here. But then by the time we got to the DS era, when Nintendo was doing so well and selling so many copies of all sorts of things in Japan, they couldn't even be bothered to release the second DS game in Japan.
Yeah.
Maybe that's part of it, though. Maybe they were doing so well with everything, they said, well, this one doesn't do as well, so deprioritize.
Yeah, some sort of like opportunity cost thing. And of course, they did get Fire Emblem DS games that we did not. So there was kind of a, maybe they felt like that was just a sort of natural, like, we'll go with, you know, what they thought the Western players liked better at the time.
Yeah, but even then, like, usually companies will then release those games in Japan as like Super Mario USA or Final Fantasy USA, and they didn't even do that for
because I think it was a similar thing actually with the original Advance Wars or GBA. Like, that did not come at the same time in Japan, or so, and there was a bundle with like the two games, Black Hole Rising as well on top.
Yes.
Like, there's a very odd history with that series. I don't think it augurs all that well, unfortunately, for its continued survival. But I would love to see it come back on Switch or anything else, to be honest.
Mid-tier budget, maybe not a full-length game. They can sell more content later, online only. Oh, there it is. You sell a smaller game, and then you add more chapters to it, and then later you just have a retail release with the full game. Or you don't,
sure.
if it didn't live up to expectations.
That's another thing they did. I mean, it was Freaky Forms that had that path to it, you know, where Freaky Forms was a digital-only game, and then that got scaled up to...
Freaky Forms Deluxe.
Deluxe, yeah. So, again, there's some precedent for these sort of things. It'd just be interesting to see how that kind of develops when, 3DS games, obviously the ceiling on it is kind of $40 or like $50 in some cases, right? Where there's not Nintendo stuff, but other publishers sometimes.
The Atlas tax.
Yeah, Atlas tax. Yeah. If the ceiling's higher with Switch, how much does that drag everything else up, and how much does that affect the capacity for a middle ground? I think it's something we don't know yet, and so it's kind of hard to see. I guess the performance of some of this stuff, I'd put Bomberman squarely in that category, so it's going to be a really interesting test case in a lot of different ways. You know, kind of a retro character, a kind of game that you wouldn't necessarily associate with full price these days at launch. I obviously can't speak to the quality of the game or all that kind of stuff, but that's going to be really interesting to see how that fares, because it might indicate quite a lot about what we could expect for the feasibility of some of these things coming back.
Yeah. Guillaume, do you have any others you want to do?
Well, just find this conversation funny because I went pretty hard on digital downloads with the 3DS and the Wii U, and I'm kind of planning on going back to physical releases more because usually I can find them cheaper, which is sad. Like, it speaks to the eShop. But also, I find that it's surprising. Like, you look on what people sell used on Amazon or eBay, and Wii U and 3DS games, some of them have kept their value, and so that's a great way to keep financing new games and all of that. And there's also like the reason why I would want to go physical is also because of the paltry storage space.
Hypothetically, it's going to be, there's going to be a day one patch for the SD. Micro SDXC compatibility. So theoretically, that's going to go up to like 2 terabytes or something, but those don't really exist yet, and they're prohibitively expensive on the upper scale. Yes. So, it's not like a hopeless situation by any means, but I don't know how well it's going to work out in practicality yet. So, I think, certainly Zelda, which is, 13 gigs, they're putting it at least in the States, in size. Which is basically half of that. What I bet you, they say explicitly, some of the 32 is reserved for the OS and all that stuff.
Right.
So chances are Zelda would take up half of the memory on Switch off the bat.
Right.
So I think I'd go physical with that, because I ain't going to be desperate to be swapping out games in the early going anyway. So it's not such an issue. So there's that component of it, certainly.
Yeah.
Fair enough. All right, well, that's going to do it for email and the show this week. If you have any emails, you could send them to us. Any emails at this point, just send them. I don't care. What do you got? you got like a timeshare offer? Send it on over. Let's do this. RFN at NintendoWorldReport.com. We may use them for the show. Also, a reminder, we announced last week our next retroactive. It is Princess Tomato in the Salad Kingdom. It is unfortunately only available on the Wii Virtual Console if you are not European. If you are European, you'll figure it out, I'm sure.
I'm sorry. We didn't check that before we announced it, and then it was too late to go back, so...
It wasn't, but we decided not to. but we don't have a date for this one yet. It's gonna be in March, probably. Just look at the calendar right now, but...
It's going to be tough to get people to participate pre-Switch.
It could be... Yeah, maybe before Switch. We'll
sure.
We're gonna
23rd, maybe, or the 2nd. Like, we record on the 2nd.
Oh my
March,
god,
so.
We do. We record on the 2nd. No one's going to want to hear that episode. Hey, okay, do you want to listen to us talk about Princess Tomato while you play Zelda? We'll figure it out, but start playing. It's not going to be too far down the road. So get going. Also, I want to thank Johnny for being here today. He left me something to plug for him. He wants you to know I'm not going to read his script. He's not John Lindemann.
He didn't read his script either.
I know. Episode 150 of Box Office Poison is now out. It's their biggest episode of the year, where the guys do their top 5 movies of 2016. I can tell you what's almost certainly not on it. Monster Trucks.
For many reasons.
But you can probably check out John somewhere. We've lost him. But on that, Greg, what is our music to end this week?
Right, so this week we have a piece of music to commemorate the passing of the founder of Namco, Masaya Nakamura. Of course, hugely seminal role in popularizing arcade games and stuff like Pac-Man and Galaga, and then in turn helping to popularize the Famicom in the early days of that system. You know, in sort of 83, 84, where before stuff like Super Mario Brothers came along. You know, obviously their relationship with Nintendo had some ups and downs over the years, but it's quite close again now when you think of stuff like Smash Brothers, of course, developed by Namco Bandai as they are now, and Pokken as well, and things like that. But I went for a sort of something from their arcade roots, but not quite as iconic as Batman and Gallagher for this music selection. So this is a track from Mr. Driller franchise. I think they probably debuted in one of the arcade games, but then showed up later on in Nintendo games, particularly Mr. Driller Drill Land, which is a Japan only, GameCube only installment in the series, which is actually a lot of fun. I have played it. It's a really good game, but probably pretty damn obscure, as you might
expect. It was on my hit list in Japan, but I just couldn't find a copy.
It has a it and other games in the series have a shockingly rich soundtrack for a sort of more action oriented falling block game. I don't think you'd necessarily guess that that's what's going on with this soundtrack if you just heard it completely out of context. And this track, I feel, is particularly enjoyable and apt for a sort of somber occasion like this. But he lived into his 90s and led a very distinguished life and career, so we can celebrate here with this piece of music. I hope everybody enjoys it.
Excellent. Thank you, Greg. And on that, it's time to end the show. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Do 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 do